ないと。
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Egg and Knight. I am your co-host, Christos Antonio. Japan Cuts is a New York-based film festival of new Japanese cinema organized by the Japan Society. Specializing in an eclectic program of blockbusters, independent productions, experimental and documentary films from established and emerging directors in the industry, the festival has been running annually since 2007. This year, they inaugurated their 14th consecutive festival, but due to the coronavirus pandemic, Japan Cuts has converted to an online-only format for the first time. Deputy Director of Film at the Japan Society and Film Programmer/Organizer for Japan Cuts, Kaze Watanabe, was gracious enough to sit down with us to discuss this process. Hope you enjoy. So I wanted to start off again by thanking you for your time. I'm sure with the festival ongoing at the time of this recording, you have a bit on your plate.
Yeah, a little bit, but nothing compared to an in-person festival.
It's true. So the usual light icebreaker kind of question we tend to ask our guests on this show is generally, what was the film that got them into Japanese cinema? And sometimes, like maybe in your case, the question cannot be so light as we hoped.
Well, the film that got me into Japanese cinema is the same that got me into thinking about film and movies in a more serious way in general, which was Kurosawa's Ron, which I had kind of randomly gotten from a Blockbuster rental shelf because it had a cool cover, you know, that kind of situation. I knew a little bit about Japanese cinema, but not a whole lot. And that was kind of the gateway.
Yeah, it's true. Kurosawa was also my gateway, but mine was Seven Samurai. So it's a common answer we get because, as expected, it's a great, as you said, gateway.
Yeah, and it's about what's available to you. You know what I mean? Like, it was a very slim selection in that international section of Blockbuster. So if that DVD hadn't been there, it might have been even more delayed. So Kurosawa probably had more exposure for Western audiences just because there's more of his films available on DVD or home media. So it's easier for him to start there as a discovery.
That's a good point. And speaking of access to Japanese cinema, just in general, so the big thing about this year's festival, this is the 14th edition of the festival itself, and the first to convert to an online-only format due to the coronavirus. At the time when it was officially recognized as a global health pandemic back in March, had the festival lineup been finalized more or less?
No, we typically finalize in early May, like let's say the first week in May, where we usually have everything confirmed to the point where we have to write film descriptions. And what we usually start with design for the print brochure or the print program. So that's usually our earliest deadline, which happens around May. So we push the selection until then. By March, we usually have about half of it locked down in, at the very least. So yeah, it was not the case where we had the full festival lineup booked and then we decided to go online. We were kind of in the middle and then had to switch gears.
I see. So when exactly, like I think you answered this question a little bit, but when exactly was the decision made to go online only? And how has like the Japan Society overall been adapting to this format?
I'm struggling to remember just because time has really changed.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Experience since we started staying home. But it must have been early April or something. Because, you know, in addition to Japan Cuts, at Japan Society, we organize like year-round film programming. Which includes thematic film series. So we had one scheduled for early to mid-April focusing on Japanese sports films, tied to anticipation of the Olympics. And that we had to cancel that because our last day open at Japan Society was maybe March 15th or something. So forcing us to do that, to cancel that, kind of made us realize we can't do the festival as usual. Repeat the second part of your question.
The second part of the question was, how has the Japan Society been adapting to this format? Because this is like new ground for a lot of film festivals about going online only at such short notice.
Yeah, and Japan Society has so many programming departments. It's a really dynamic programming departments that include performing arts and talk series and a gallery, showing fine art. So everyone has a unique challenge in how to virtualize their programming. And it's a unique challenge depending on what you want to show. You know, making a gallery virtual is not the same as making a film festival virtual. So there have been some unique ways to use tools like Zoom and webinars to change the way we think about engaging with audiences with our, respective areas of expertise or experience and connections. So they did stuff like artist visits or studio visits with artists virtually. They found ways to rebroadcast some live performances that that we hosted in the building, but which hadn't been shown as video. So they kind of took that out of the archive, and we're all finding our way to adjust. For film, it was, perhaps a little easier because it's so specific, and it's an industry in itself, a for-profit industry. So people were finding ways to make this work for them. So there were other examples that we kind of could look to adapt or borrow approaches.
And speaking more on that and changing the format, a large appeal of Japan Cuts was like the participation of these emerging and established Japanese filmmakers to come to the screenings, participate in Q&As, and like interact with the New York international cinema scene. How has Japan Cuts been working to try and maintain that kind of feel, that like more intimate access to that international film community?
Yeah, that's really one of the most valuable and important parts of the festival is offering access to these filmmakers in person. And it's meaningful not just for the audience members, but also for the filmmakers themselves often. Many times, they're showing their work for the first time outside of Japan, things like that. So it's hard to replicate that the special feeling of the in-person festival, but we did want to do our best to maintain some of that sense of community and person-to-person contact. So, we planned some live Q&As, something to look forward to and schedule around, as well as asked for video intros to all of the films from the filmmakers. And most all participated by providing a short 1 to 3 minute video introducing their film the way they would maybe if they were about to show it at the festival in person. And we're encouraged by that. I think it helps make the festival feel more like a festival when you can see the filmmakers and you can hear from them themselves. I don't know if it's enough, but it's what we did.
That was one of my consistently favorite things about the film festival this year, is seeing all the intro videos and how varied they are. Some people are using their cell phones. Some people are professionally shot. Some people are like using their laptop cameras. It really kind of gives a much more personal feel to it. So I think you did a really great job on that.
Yeah, we're really grateful that they're all wanting to participate. And I think it kind of speaks to turning this circumstance into an opportunity. And for a lot of the filmmakers, they still realize that it's a way to connect. So it wasn't pulling teeth, to ask for these videos. And I'm glad you noticed them. You know, it really does add to the experience of watching the film by watching these intros first.
More generally about the festival, like every year your programming is always impressively diverse, like showcasing mainstream and established filmmakers alongside new generation and independents and like fan favorite genre fair alongside avant-garde, experimental, documentary. How do you go about striking this balance during your selection process?
Yeah, there's no strict formula, but you know, over the years, the festival kind of changed shape, different staff were involved, kind of going in and out. And, you know, there's a lot of Japanese film festivals around. So there's always kind of the question of how do we distinguish ourselves as a festival and what we're offering. And also how to reflect the personality of the staff, you know, selecting the films, the selection committee. And it kind of gelled for us around 2015. We introduced kind of new sections to the festival that kind of forced us to always think about inclusion of certain types of films, for example, documentary films, experimental films, to make sure that we always have that kind of breadth of representation of types of filmmaking going on in Japan. And striking that balanced with what audiences want to see, you know. So we always kind of think about hitting some marks, which we never really wrote down, but between the programming staff, who's been more or less consistent since 2015, we kind of know, because we have experience of seeing the audiences year to year and what they respond to. So we try to think about them while trying to challenge them at the same time a little bit. And one of the great things about the Japan Cuts audience that I've seen over the years is that they're willing to be challenged. So many people are just willing to go in to a film that they know nothing about that looks a little strange. So we can't do that too much. You know, it's balancing that with what we know they'd like, what would sell really well, you know, what would be appealing to the broadest audience possible, because we also want to bring in new fans of Japanese cinema. Sometimes it's easier to do that with some types of films than others, such as a studio film or a samurai film or a cat film, something like that.
Okay, great. That kind of leads into my next question, because as you said, around like the mid-2010s, you started adding all these like curated programs and selections under certain themes and areas of the industry. And around the time, you also introduced the classics section. This year, you have three entries in Yoji Yamada's Torasan series to coincide with the latest edition. Are these classic selections based on any criteria, or is it more dependent on what is currently getting remastered by the film studios and distribution companies at the time?
Yeah, it's more of the latter. You know, the classic section has kind of been in flux, and we've used that section different ways. So we've had a subtitle where it's rediscoveries and restorations. So restorations is one thing. You know, if there's a new restoration out there, it's worth showing for a chance of rediscovery. And there's a whole festival circuit for these types of films. You know, Cannes has a classic section. There's whole festivals dedicated to restoration premieres. And then we've also use as opportunity to just show older films that are in dialogue with other parts or other films being shown in the festival. So for example, we had Shinya Tsukamoto last year, and we asked him to pick one of his older films to show. And it wasn't a restoration or remaster or anything, but just one of his library titles on 35 millimeter. But in that case, it served to expand audience's experience with Tsukamoto, who is being celebrated that year with a centerpiece film. So yeah, it's changed. And then this year, Torasan seemed like a good opportunity because Shochiku made all these beautiful 4K restorations of the film. tied to a big anniversary. They're celebrating a big anniversary this year with their 100th year anniversary of entering film production. And also we had this brand new Taurus on film. So we thought it was a good opportunity to expand the experience of this new one, which involves a lot of clips of the older films in this 50 film series. So it worked out well this year, but it's always like starting from scratch every year about how to use this section. So new things may come from there.
Yeah, and building off of that, just more broadly, why do you think it's important to celebrate the classics of Japanese cinema alongside with the contemporary? Because Japan Cuts itself is celebrating new Japanese cinema, and alongside it are these kind of like reflections of the past. Why do you think personally it's important to include that kind of acknowledgement?
Yeah, one of the opportunities a film festival presents is kind of a discovery and education, so that you're not dealing with just the film in itself in a vacuum. I mean, the idea that we're trying to keep present with all the selections is that this is part of a continuum of Japanese film history. There's a dialogue going on between the past and the present all the time, whether that's filmmakers who have had long careers or new filmmakers who are responding to what's already been made, whether that's explicitly acknowledged or not. And I think that's important. And I always want to kind of remind people that there's a lot out there. The idea that this is only just the tip of the iceberg of what you can discover with Japanese cinema. And if you like this film, you should check out some of these older titles, and then encourage people to kind of check things out for themselves. Well, that's a kind of general idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great setup for a film festival that's really centered around discovery. One thing that I'm personally curious about, midway through the festival, it was announced that Toshiaki Toyoda's The Day of Destruction was added to the lineup under like a 24-hour only streaming rule, and served kind of like as a premiere of sorts of that film. How did this addition come about? Was that kind of like in talks beforehand, but the film wasn't finished, or?
It wasn't in talks beforehand. Toyoda is a filmmaker who has a particularly long and strong history with the festival. In 2013, he received the Cut Above Award. We've shown many of his films, and this precedes me by many years, this relationship. But, of course, we kept it going, and we had agreed to show his short film, Wolf's Calling, beforehand. And the deal was made pretty much directly with director Toyoda. So it was quite easy to keep communication open. And he actually pitched the idea of doing this very limited worldwide virtual screening timed to the opening of the theatrical release of the film in Japan. Of course we took the opportunity right away as a very exciting and new thing for us to do. And it worked out quite well. So we're grateful that he trusted us to handle this, and that he felt that we were a festival that could create the necessary excitement for a new title from him.
Yeah, it almost seemed too perfect of a film to select for this 24-hour only streaming rights, considering like for a festival in the middle of a pandemic, because of how timely that film is when you actually watch it.
Yeah, it's a real lightning bolt of contemporary the contemporary moment. So it worked out really well that way. And the reason he wanted to do it on the 24th, or that the film opened on the 24th, is that it was supposed to be the opening day of the Olympics, which, as we all know, were canceled due to coronavirus. So there's that's the extra bit of
the timing thing.
Okay, and just more in general, it might be too early to determine this, but do you expect to, like, do you expect in like the future to keep some kind of online access formats a part of future editions of the festival when things get back to normal, hopefully, ?
Yeah, I think definitely. And I think you'll hear that answer probably from a lot of festivals that experienced turning their festival into an online one due to the pandemic. It just really opened up a whole set of possibilities that really we hadn't considered before. You know, it forced us to think in a new way and to think about audience in a new way. And the response has been so positive so far in terms of accessibility. You know, people who could never have been in New York in the summer or at all, people who maybe hadn't even heard of the festival because it's not local to them. So it would seem like a shame to just drop all these new discoveries that we've made turning the festival virtual, to not continue it in some way, shape, or form. We would still have to think about how to do that elegantly without detracting from the excitement of the in-person festival, which we value very highly. So that's the long answer. The short answer is just yes, we'll have to figure out how, but it's definitely been talked about keeping some virtual component of the festival even after this is all over with.
It's great to hear. And it kind of leads into this other question of what have been some of your main takeaways from this last minute complete shift to online access? And just more broadly, what do you think, with all this impact of these decisions, like what do you think the 15th edition of Japan Cuts will look like? But I think you kind of like already covered that with that answer.
Yeah. One thing is this reminded us that we can't plan too far ahead. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to predict too much. Who knows where we'll be in a year, especially as the situation changes day to day. But the lessons definitely were as a reminder about how we're constantly going to face these new challenges, and the industry is going to change all the time, and we have to be ready to adapt and to find a way to make it a positive, find the positive aspect of that change and to use it for our benefit and for the benefit of our audiences. And that's happened several times already. It's a slower change in terms of from analog to digital technology. That was a whole big thing. The more forceful change from in-person to virtual is just another part of the way cinema is always kind of changing and adapting to circumstances and technologies, and that we have to be ready to be adaptable. And it opened up kind of a new perspective on what we mean by audience. You know, Japan Society is a New York-based organization. You know, to see our programming, you really have to be in our auditorium on 47th Street. But the experience with the virtual festival is that there's an audience out there, and I think it's going to be a lesson applied not just for the festival, but for Japan Society at large, where I think we'll always now have to think about a virtual component for an audience that can't physically be with us, but still values and enjoys what we have to offer, whether that's across the nation or even beyond the US to North America to internationally. The day of the destruction screening, the Toyota film, was great because we didn't have to restrict it to just the US. It was open internationally. So we could see people buying tickets in Russia and South America. And that was really encouraging because It's a completely organic audience. We don't have any kind of experience in cultivating those audiences. So it's kind of exciting to think about the virtual sphere that way.
Yeah, that's incredible to hear that it had such a global impact like that. That's amazing news. And I just, for like a final question, second penultimate question, I guess.
Sure.
This might not be able to answer this, but just more broadly from like your experience and your knowledge of the industry, what do you think that will look like in 2021, the Japanese film industry? Do you suspect a lot of coronavirus themed films coming down the pipeline?
I would think so. And I don't think that's going to be unique to Japan. You know, this is a global pandemic and there's filmmakers all over the world experiencing this. So I'm sure there's going to be a wave of films that address the pandemic in some way, directly or indirectly. But what the state of the industry will be, I mean, it's a good question. I don't quite know. I think in general, I found that the Japanese studios and big distributors are a little slower to adapt to change than some of the stuff that I see happen in New York and stuff. As for example, and shifting over to virtual screenings, it was a bit of a paradigm shift. But I think by 2021, there will be a lot more embrace where there will be, licensing models set up to accommodate virtual screening requests that, you know, when we started this, were not in place yet and kind of had to be made up as we went along. But now that we've done it and other festivals have done it, distributors can respond to that market that maybe they hadn't considered before. We're talking about temporary video on demand kind of stuff. So, that could affect how people engage with distribution, how filmmakers talk to their film distributors in terms of what they are willing to show and how they're willing to show their films. So I would suspect that there's going to be some more openness to these new avenues than there is now.
Yeah, we can only hope that it really opens up the industry to consider greater access to their product and to all the films that are being produced annually in Japan. And a parting question, final question of the interview. Do you have any personal recommendations from this year's lineup you'd like to leave our listeners with to prioritize for the last few days of the festival?
Yeah, that's always a tough question because there's just so much, and I value each of these films for different reasons. So it really depends on your taste and mood. But if you go to our homepage, we've kind of highlighted the big films that you should prioritize. That we're giving tentpole positions, such as Special Actors, our opening film, which is the follow-up to One Cut of the Dead from director Shinichiro Ueda. We have Fukushima 50 as our centerpiece, which is a urgent blockbuster with Ken Watanabe and Koichi Sato. But there's just so much in the festival, and there's different avenues you can take. So I would encourage everyone to kind of go section by section and see what appeals to you. I will say that this year we have a focus or a sidebar of sorts for director Nobuhiko Obayashi. And the one film that everybody has to see is his latest and last film, Labyrinth of Cinema, which is about 3-hour, really avant-garde kind of meditation on war and on cinema and his kind of swan song of sorts and these thematic focuses he's had especially in the last part of his career, where he's really thinking about Japan's legacy of and its involvement in the war and what that did for future generations, because he grew up with the war as a Hiroshima-born Japanese. So I would encourage you to check out that. And then after that, check out a documentary called Seijo's Story, 60 Years of Making Films, which is about him meaning Obayashi and his wife, Kyoko, as they recount their 60-year marriage together and 60-year history of making films together, because Kyoko is a producer on pretty much all of his films. And this particular moment that the documentarians capture is as they're in post-production of Labyrinth of Cinema. So it's kind of a really neat 1-2 punch to experience the film and then this kind of behind the scenes to get to know the filmmaker more, especially if you don't know a lot about him other than Hausu, which maybe every fan of Japanese cinema is very well versed in. So I'll leave it there with the recommendations. And there's also just a panel on Obayashi's life that is quite good if you need even more context. So please check out all that content.
Yeah, well said. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that, but you handled the question very well.
No, it's amazing how mumbly I get, even though I'm asked this question very constantly. I should come up with a short terse answer, but there you go.
All right, I think that'll do it for this interview. I want to just thank you again on behalf of Agonite for participating in this interview. And yeah, any parting words?
No, other than thank you, and thank you for your interest. Let's keep seeing what's out there in Japanese cinema and keep talking about it. There's so much yet to be discovered. And the more we talk about it, the more we'll find out.
Japan Cuts is currently streaming online until Friday, July 31st at midnight. Tickets are available at japancuts.japansociety.org.